invite you to go with me to the Gospel of John one more time, John chapter 21. Hannah sang that Christ is Lord of the small broken things. And what do we read in John chapter 21 but a bunch of broken disciples being ministered to by the Lord of glory, really giving them the personal attention, the compassion, and the restoration that they needed at this very critical time of their lives. As I mentioned last week, I chose to extend our Easter series by one more message so that we could finish out the Gospel of John. We have looked at chapters 18 to 20. And we have seen in these stories a display of the majesty of Jesus Christ in a number of ways. He is majestic as he is arrested and tried so unfairly. He was majestic even in the horror and the humiliation of the crucifixion. And last week we were considering his majesty, especially in his resurrection. And after all that glory, all the glory of those events, we might ask, what is left? What remains to be seen? Thinking especially about chapter 20, what could possibly be more majestic than resurrection? Actually, scripturally, there is something more glorious than that. It's the reality that our risen Savior is King of Kings, that he is ruling even now, and that he is going to come back to establish his reign entirely on earth someday. In fact, the Apostle John himself wrote a whole book about that aspect of the glory of Christ, and it's called the Book of Revelation. Yet what is left in this book is not quite along those lines. It's not about the triumphant Jesus coming from heaven to slay his enemies and to establish his kingdom. Really, the body of the Gospel of John comes to a close in the last couple of verses of chapter 20, which, of course, tells us that these signs in John are recorded so that people would believe that he is the Christ and that by believing they would have life in his name. The book really could have ended there. That captures the essence of the message of this book. But the Holy Spirit guided John to add chapter 21 as an epilogue. And it gives us a closing scene where some loose ends that had been addressed throughout the book but were not totally resolved, where some loose ends are wrapped up, especially as it relates to some of the human characters in the book. And we find here three developments. In verses 1 to 14, Jesus provides fish for seven of his disciples who have gone fishing. In verses 15 to 19, Jesus questions his disciple Peter about the level of Peter's love for him. And in verses 20 to 25, Jesus and Peter discuss a little bit the fate of another disciple, John, who wrote this book. And that leads to some final comments as the book comes to a close. There's a lot here about the disciples, about their personal struggles, about what was in store for them. And yet, let us not allow that focus on the human to take the primary focus off of where it has been throughout these chapters. And that is the majesty of Jesus Christ. The fact that Christ really is the one being spotlighted in these stories, especially in the first one, it is clear by what that first story is bracketed by. Maybe you noticed this, but when the story begins in chapter 21, verse 1, it says, "After this, Jesus revealed himself to the disciples." And after the incident takes place in verse 14, this was now the third time that Jesus was revealed to the disciples. So you find the whole thing described with the word revealed. This is something about the Lord Jesus Christ being put on display, being manifested. In fact, You find the word revealed three times in chapter 21, but it is not the first time in the Gospel of John that that word has occurred. It occurred at the very beginning when in chapter 1, verse 31, John says, "For this purpose I came, baptizing with water, that he might," Jesus, the Lamb of God, "might be revealed to Israel." In chapter 2, verse 11, after Jesus turned the water to wine, it says, "This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory." Same word here could be translated revealed. He revealed his glory and his disciples believed in him. In chapter 3, verse 21, when chapter 3 goes on about the new birth that Jesus came to preach, it says, "Whoever does what is true comes to the light so that it may be clearly seen," same word, "so that it may be revealed that his works have been carried out in God." In chapter 7, when Jesus' human family is a bit frustrated with him and they're saying, "Look, if you claim to be the Messiah, stop being kind of vague about it. Just come out and tell everybody." And they say this, "For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known properly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." Same word, reveal, manifest yourself to the world. Show them who you really are. Chapter 7, verse 4. In chapter 9, verse 3, Jesus heals a blind man. And before that, there's this discussion about why he was blind in the first place. Jesus says, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be revealed or displayed in him." Same term, chapter 9, verse 3, "so that the healing of the blind man is an unfolding of the purposes of God through the power of Jesus Christ." And when Jesus looks back on his whole ministry, particularly about his disciples in chapter 17, that prayer that he lifts up at the end, in verse 6 he says, "I have manifested or revealed your name to the people whom you gave me out of the world." And so you see that that term revealed in John is strongly associated with Christ, not just doing things, not just helping people, not just teaching, but Christ through his teaching and through his mighty works, putting God on display, putting his own divine nature on display so that all may stand in awe and worship him as he deserves. And that idea of self-revelation, the majesty of Christ, continues right into this final chapter. It is most prominent in the first incident, but really Christ is displaying himself in all three of his interactions with the disciples. And so for our theme this morning, we see that Jesus is majestic in his discipling specifically. That's what he's doing here. He is ministering on a personal level to his disciples. He is restoring them or encouraging them or building their faith or preparing them. And in all of those ways, as he works to mature them as his disciples, to get them going on the right path, there is this unfolding of his own divine and mighty character. Jesus is majestic in his discipling. He's majestic, first of all, in providing for his disciples. The power that it took to provide for them these many, many fish in verses 1 to 14. And the story of his provision begins with the information that the disciples had decided to go fishing in the Sea of Galilee. I want to encourage us not to overread those statements or to conclude that the disciples were abandoning their ministry and were returning permanently to their former job as fishermen. The reason they were in Galilee was because in Matthew 28:10, Jesus told them to go to Galilee and to wait for the next thing that he was to do. This was a period of waiting. They were waiting because Jesus had, in chapter 20, breathed the Spirit on them symbolically, but nothing had really happened with the Spirit yet. That was still to come. That's what Pentecost was about. They were awaiting that, and it wasn't entirely clear to them what all was going on or how this was going to happen or when it was going to happen or what exactly was going to be their role. No doubt they were confused. wondering what was going on, wondering what they were supposed to do next. And so they do the thing that they knew to do materially, and that was to go fishing. After all, they had to feed themselves during this waiting period. And as they're in this period of confusion, Jesus understands their struggle, and he shows up on the shore to encourage them and to direct them, and particularly to provide for them. He works this mighty miracle as they had been out there for a long time, all night, and had caught no fish, verse 3 tells us. He says, cast, verse 6, the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some. So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of fish. You see so much here of the providence of God in the arrangement of these circumstances. How could it be that these experienced fishermen could spend the whole night and not catch a single fish? Because there was a divine message that told them, get away from that boat. And then that same divine providence moved them at that moment, a whole bunch of them, to the right side of the boat so that they would be there at the moment when Jesus was going to instruct them to cast the net. And there were 153 of them that were hauled in. You read the commentaries, and interpreters have suggested any number of wild ideas about the symbolic meaning of the number 153. Those interpretations are a testimony to the very fruitful imagination of people reading the Bible. They are not a testimony to anything clearly indicated by the context of this passage. There's really no objective basis for making much about the specific number here, except for this point. That's a bunch of fish. That's a lot of fish that were pulled in at one time. The point is the power of Christ to provide for them in such an abundant way. If there is symbolism here, it would have to be in connection with an earlier incident, something that took place at the beginning of Jesus' ministry that was very similar to this incident, and something that was actually a part of how he called them, some of them, originally to be his disciples. And it's a story back in Luke chapter 5, and a very similar situation where they had failed in their efforts, and when Jesus directed them to go out into the deep, and they tried again, there was once again a whole mass of fish that they were collecting. In fact, it said there were so many that they were afraid that the nets were going to rip, and they had to get some help in order to pull them in. And what was Peter's response on that occasion? He didn't say, this is great. This guy is going to revolutionize my fishing business. I'm going to take him with me from now on, and he'll take me to the right spot, and I'm going to get rich with all of these fish that he knows where they are. That's not what he says. He says, falling down at Jesus' knees, he said, depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord. He was struck with the majesty, the deity, the power, the wisdom of this individual. He and all who were with him, it says, were astonished at the catch of fish, including James and John, who were Simon's partners. Jesus says, do not be afraid. From now on, you will be catching men. So he uses the fish now as an illustration of what Christ will be able to do through these men, catching others, influencing others. And when they had brought their boats to the land, they left everything and followed him. That was the kind of formal, all-out beginning of their discipleship. It started that way, and it ends in a parallel way, almost as though the Lord is renewing them in his work of using them in discipleship. And just as Peter had said, I'm a sinful man, O Lord. Here it is John, when this happens, connects the dots, and he says, it is the Lord, chapter 21, verse 7. Probably as well, we ought to bring into this then the other part about discipleship and about catching men, that this following of Christ was not only about themselves personally benefiting from his ministry and growing themselves, but that it was about the Lord using them to influence others to become disciples as well. No doubt, the memory of the first catch of fish flooded Peter's mind, and it prompted him to jump into the water and to rush as fast as he could to get to Jesus. And he gets to the shore, and there's Jesus making breakfast for them. What a moving touch with which to close this gospel. Just a few chapters earlier, before his death, Jesus was washing their feet, and he was humbling himself to serve them, and now he's over here cooking breakfast for them. You wonder where the fish came from. You wonder where the bread came from. The Bible doesn't say. He invites them to add some of their fish to the grill, and they have a memorable breakfast together. Here is the Lord providing fish in large quantity, and here's the Lord graciously feeding these people who had been so unfaithful to him. What is the point? The point is that Jesus has all the resources available to enable his disciples to carry out his will for them. And that if he is determined to work in their lives and to work through them, he is able to overcome even their own failures in that process, to bring them back to himself and to give them everything that is needed for them to do their task. And he is going to humbly serve them so that they are in a position to be able to serve him. Maybe somebody's out there today and you, like these men, are overwhelmed by your failures, or you're sort of waiting for instructions and you don't know what you're supposed to do next in your discipleship for Christ. Maybe you are discouraged by your circumstances and the false starts in your past. This passage is assuring you, and it is assuring me, that we cannot go wrong if we are humbly trusting in and following this Messiah. We cannot go wrong when the one that we are following and proclaiming is the one, first of all, who was raised from the dead, and number two, now in this passage, the one who is the Lord of creation, who is able to direct these fish at his will. And that's just one little token of the miracles that he had already done, recorded in this gospel. How can we go wrong? How can we ultimately fail if the one we're trusting is the Lord of resurrection and is the Lord of creation? This is one of the things that is being revealed here, the majesty of Jesus Christ in these mighty provisions. I want you to notice, as we move on to the next part of the passage, that in verse 9, when it is talking about the breakfast that Jesus was cooking, it says, when they got out on land, they saw a charcoal fire in place with fish laid out on it and bread. Think about that expression, charcoal fire. It's really one word in Greek. It occurs only one other time in the entire New Testament. And do you know where that is? It is at chapter 18, verse 18. Now the servants and officers had made a charcoal fire because it was cold, and they were standing and warming themselves. Peter also was with them standing and warming himself. The only other time that that word for charcoal fire appears in all the New Testament is in the story of Peter huddled around a fire with a bunch of other people trying to get warm on that night of his trials. And it was associated with the devastating denials of Christ that Peter made. And that sets the stage, that reminder of the charcoal fire sets the stage for what is going to happen next in 15 to 20. These verses tell us that Jesus is majestic in specifically restoring his disciples. He provides for them at the beginning, and now he is focusing on Peter and doing a very personal, though somewhat painful, work of restoring this one. It seems to be in the sequence of all the resurrection appearances of Christ that actually Jesus and Peter had a separate meeting before this. We don't really know a lot of what happened there, but the one that is recorded here is so appropriate and so fitting to what we want to find out coming out of the closing chapters of this gospel. What about Peter? How did Jesus view him? How is the Lord going to respond to him? What about his denials? What happens demonstrates that though we are disappointed by Peter and he is frustrated with himself, again, Jesus is so great and so glorious that he can overcome the failures and put this man back again in a position of usefulness. He is majestic in his work of restoration. Let's read verses 15 to 17. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Feed my lambs." He said to him a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep." Probably all of us can relate with the sense of bitterness and of anxiety mingled with a genuine heart for Christ that after a time of failure goes back to the Lord in confession of sins and says, "Lord, you know everything. You know my failures. You know my sins. I'm broken about that. But Lord, you know as well that I do love you." And there's a lot of discussion in this passage regarding the specific terms for love that are used. There's also some interchange of vocabulary between tending and feeding and between lambs and sheep. And there are many who would take especially the words for love and make a distinction. Since the Lord used the verbal form of the word agape in the first two questions toward Peter, a word that often has to do with a self-sacrificing, committed sort of love, and distinguishing it from the word that Peter uses, which is the word phileo, which has more to do with your affection, your sort of emotional bond and sense of closeness to somebody. And by the time you get to the third, Jesus begins to use now Peter's word, and Peter replies that yes, indeed, he loves him. There are actually good arguments on both sides of the debate as to whether we ought to make a point about those two terms being different from one another and communicating something different. I tend to think there is a distinction that's being made. I'm not going to be dogmatic about it, but what I do want to do is to keep the focus on the big ideas of this passage. And let me share those with you. First of all, when Jesus asks, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" That expression could also be interpreted in various ways. It seems in the context of this incident and being surrounded by some of the other disciples and especially by some of the comments Peter had made before that Jesus is saying, "Do you love me more than these other disciples love me?" And why would Jesus ask him that? I mean, how arrogant would it be for somebody to even think that they loved Christ more than somebody else and to make a point of that? Well, actually, Peter had said that or something like it. When in chapter 13, He says, I will lay down my life for you. And that's what led to the prediction that he was going to deny him. Peter had a way of sort of pushing himself forward. He had natural leadership abilities, and God used that. But really, there was an attitude issue that's reflected, where he was thinking that somehow his devotion and his abilities and his willingness to sacrifice for Christ were greater than that of the other disciples. And what he learns as the story goes on, here's our first idea, is that our love for Christ may well be smaller than we think it is. Jesus actually asks him the question, do you love me, three times. And he says to him, tend my sheep or feed my lambs three times. And that is answering the fact that Peter had denied him exactly three times. And it's kind of a mix of rebuke and restoration all at once, as the three times here he is being reminded that he really didn't love the Lord to the depth that he thought, or more than other people. That his love for Christ was actually smaller in the moment of temptation than he had thought it was. The Lord really was putting this man in his place. Our love for Christ may well be smaller than we think it is. But secondly, one of the other things Jesus is doing in this restoration is teaching that our ministry to other disciples is a key demonstration of our love to Christ. How would you know that you love Jesus? How would you know? Well, maybe you've heard this statement. I think this is appropriate at this point. Sometimes it's harder to live for Christ than it is to die for Christ. We could probably all imagine these grandiose scenarios where we would do something just incredible, something dramatic for Christ, laying down our life for him. And Jesus is saying, you know what? Love for me is often shown by washing people's feet, by working with lambs, and all of the negative connotations of lambs as those that are dumb and stray from the path and do things that endanger them, and you're going after them and you're pursuing them and you're healing them, you're rounding them up, you're cleaning them off. And the routineness of that, the tedium of that, the burden of that, now that kind of lifestyle, now that would show that you're really loving me if you take care of my dumb sheep, just like I'm taking care of you right now, Peter. It's fitting that that comment should be made in John. Once again, there's all these connections to earlier teaching in this gospel, because it is in this gospel, chapter 10, that Jesus identifies himself as the good shepherd, as the one who goes out and seeks the sheep and cares for them and protects them and lays down his life for them. And now he says, Peter, I'm entrusting this same kind of ministry, and that's going to be the way you show me that you love me. It really stuck with Peter, made a big impact on him, because when he goes to write his first epistle and he's talking to elders, he says to them, shepherd the flock of God, exercising oversight not under compulsion but willingly, as God would have you, not for shameful gain but eagerly, not domineering over those in your charge, but being an example. It sounds like Peter has had a turn of heart, because he was a domineering person prior to this. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. Peter learned the lesson, and he went on to be an exemplary shepherd. But as we go on, the last couple of statements that Jesus makes to Peter, it is clear that the day would come when he was going to suffer martyrdom. And he, unlike many Christians, was going to be called to pay the ultimate price of his life through having others take him where he does not want to go, stretching out his hands. This, verse 19 says, this he said to show by what kind of death he was to glorify God. Very similar language about Jesus' own death, glorifying God, now it would be eventually Peter's turn to die in that same way. And tradition tells us that he did not feel qualified to die in the same way, and so he asked that he would be crucified upside down. Peter would eventually lay down his life like Jesus did. He was not ready for it in the initial years of discipleship, but the day did come, and what do we learn from this? It is that we can expect that our love for Christ will be tested as well. There is the test of the normal shepherding, ministry kinds of discipleship that we have, but there are tests as well that are really going to put it to us, and that we're going to find out as we're being sifted through that just exactly what's going on in our hearts. Peter failed once, but praise the Lord that he triumphed in the end, that God built that level of devotion and character into him. And what was it that the Lord used to prepare him for that? Well, it seems to me that he used as one tool the very conversation that they were having here. And the point I want to make, really, it's our last thought about this restoration, is yes, these are truths and lessons that Peter had to learn, that we've got to learn as disciples. This is how it works. This is what we're called upon to do. But this passage is primarily about Jesus and his gracious, forgiving, patient work with this struggling disciple. What we learn is that Jesus' love for us is the basis of our love for him. And that Peter went on to do all those things, but it was because the Lord took pity on him and worked in his life in this way. Jesus' majesty is seen here in that despite the fact that he is God over all, that he is the God over all creation, he is so patient with these fumbling disciples, and he restores them and he enables them for ministry despite the past. He is majestic in his restoration. Now, as we close and come to the last few verses, the focus is going to shift away from Jesus and Peter to now Jesus and another disciple, and his name is John. Peter turned, verse 20, and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them. Interesting, he calls himself, and this is pretty typical, the disciple whom Jesus loved. The focus is not so much on our love for him, but on Jesus' love for us. The one who had also leaned back against him during the supper and had said, "Lord, who is it that's going to betray you?" Peter saw him. He said to Jesus, "What about this man?" Jesus said, "If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me." Our Lord here is majestic in guiding his disciples, providing for them, restoring them, and now guiding them individually. Like, he has a plan and a path for Peter. He's laid out some of what that is going to be. And he is shepherding Peter down that path, but he is shepherding John down some other path that's really none of Peter's business here. And he says, "Look, I've got that under control. You follow me in what I've laid out for you. Let me take care of John." The emphasis is on the individual nature of the discipleship. John was going to go on to feed sheep like Peter did, but it would take different forms. When you go to the book of Acts, these two are often together, but typically it is Peter who is doing the talking and Peter who is working the miracles. And yet that doesn't mean there wasn't anything glorious for John to do. After all, John is the one who gave us the book we're reading here. John is the one that was used of the Lord to craft this gospel of the majesty of Christ. He gave us three letters, and he gave us those prophecies in Revelation. And he also had to suffer. It wasn't by a sort of one-time martyrdom, but by a tedious exile in the Isle of Patmos. And the point is that as the master, Jesus does not have one cookie cutter approach that he uses for all of his disciples. He is shepherding us individually down the path that he specifically has designed for us. When I think of this story, I think of another story in The Horse and His Boy in the Narnia series. And you might have read that, and you remember the name of the main character, Shasta. And all that he went through, really unknowingly, to fulfill a prophecy that actually he was going to be used to deliver the kingdom. He unknowingly was carrying this out. He was actually a prince and didn't know it. But at this point, he was really struggling about his circumstance and was tired and felt so sorry for himself that the tears rolled down his cheeks. And Aslan appears and begins to talk to him. Initially, Shasta is frightened, but then he calms down and feels comfortable talking to this lion. And so he told how he had never known his real father or mother, had been brought up sternly by the fishermen, told the story of his escape and how they were chased by lions and forced to swim for their lives, and of all their dangers in Tashban, and about his night among the tombs and how the beast howled at him out of the desert. And he told about the heat and thirst of their desert journey and how they were almost at their goal when another lion chased them and wounded Ervis, and also how very long it was since he had had anything to eat. You ever feel that way in your discipleship? Just kind of dumping on Christ that way? Well, the Lord doesn't tell you to shut up. He'll listen. But then he'll go on to disciple you as well. "I do not call you unfortunate," said the large voice. "Don't you think it was bad luck to meet so many lions?" said Shasta. "There was only one lion," said the voice. "What on earth do you mean? I've just told you there were at least two the first night, and there was only one, but he was swift of foot." "How do you know?" "I was the lion." And as Shasta gaped with open mouth and said nothing, the voice continued, "I was the lion who forced you to join with Ervis. I was the cat who comforted you among the houses of the dead. I was the lion who drove the jackals from you while you slept. I was the lion who gave the horses the new strength of fear for the last mile so that you should reach King Lun in time. And I was the lion who, you do not remember, who pushed the boat in which you lay, a child near death, so that it came to the shore where a man sat wakeful at midnight to receive you." And as he begins to recognize the absolute sovereignty of this Christ figure over all of these details of his own life, leading at every step, guiding, he begins to realize this one must also be sovereign over others who are following him, others in whose lives he's working. And so Shasta says, "Then it was you who wounded Ervis?" "It was I. But what for?" And here's the line I've been getting at. "Child," said the voice, "I am telling you your story, not hers. I tell no one any story but his own. If I will that he should be here till I return, what is that to you? You follow me." What a comfort, really, that when it comes to every aspect of our discipleship to Christ, part of his glory is that he is individually determining and directing the lives of the billions of his disciples throughout history. That includes everything: our abilities and our gifts, our geographical placement, our marital status, our family members, our other relationships, our church family, whatever would be the results of our ministry, whatever specific task he gives us to do for him. It is no small part of Jesus' glory that he has this enormous and complex plan that includes all of these details for all of his followers, and it is individually crafted for each one. Jesus says, I'll take care of him. I got a plan for him, but I got a plan for you. You follow me and let me guide these other people where I will. He is majestic in his personal, his individual guidance of his disciples. And then John, with that thought in mind, ends the book by saying, I'm the disciple who's bearing witness, and this is all true. And there are many other things that Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. What a glorious way to end this account of our glorious Christ, to say that this is just the tip of the iceberg, that there is no end to his majesty in this and so many other areas. He ends with this kind of hyperbolic statement so that you're just stunned and you're asking the question, I wonder what some of those works would be. This Jesus is majestic. As we close the service, which on the level of the disciples has been about our following Christ, our loving Christ, I don't want to end it with a hymn that's often sung and that I usually feel funny about singing anyway. The hymn that says, My Jesus, I love thee. If ever I love thee, my Jesus, 'tis now. I've sung that, and I must confess that's not true, because my love for Christ is so variable, and how do I really know that I love him today more than I did yesterday or whatever? We understand the sentiment of that. It's like Peter saying, Lord, I don't love you like I should, but I do love you. Would you believe me? Would you believe me? Would you accept that? But really, the spirit ought to be primarily, Lord, would you grow me? It's not, my Jesus, I love thee. It is, Lord, you work so that I would be able to love you, because without you, I can do nothing. And so we're going to end with the song 477, More Love to Thee.